I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Dan Bizig. Dan is a college expert, funding strategist, and founder of College and Beyond. And Dan, you recently kicked off a new business called College and Beyond with Test Prep. I know personally that you can make a huge difference in a family because you did help our daughter. And part of the reason why we personally engaged you is because you took a lot of the emotion out of the conversation. You were able to come in essence, we outsourced that process to you. Everything from helping her with her essays to looking at schools and trying to identify the ones that suited her. It's a full-time job otherwise, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. And as you know, every single family has a unique set of circumstances that are going on, whether it's with the students, you know, challenges that they may have, and quite frankly, just with the whole conversation that has to take place when it comes to the decisions that have to be made when it comes to college.
Well, and some of those decisions obviously are financial, and those are tough decisions just by themselves, aren't they?
Oh, they absolutely are. There are plenty of families who, quite frankly, just haven't been able to set aside any additional dollars for college. I mean, they're trying to make ends meet. And so that's always a challenge of trying to figure out, okay, what is the best plan, which then identifies, okay, what are the types of colleges that they need to consider that might fit into their financial affordability threshold?
Because the cost of college has done nothing over the last decade but skyrocket.
Absolutely. The problem is, you know, since the time that our children were young, many of us have been talking to our kids about the value that we place in a college education. And so the challenge that comes along with that is that we often load the kids up into the cars and we go heading out to all these prestigious schools that we've heard about, take the walk around the hallowed halls, and our children, in many cases, fall in love with these institutions before the conversation was ever made about how we were going to pay for it.
Well, and the colleges are not really helpful because in the orientation to the prospective students, one piece of the speech is always, don't worry about whether or not you can afford it because we make sure that finance is not an issue. And that may be true for very low income people, but it's really not true for what most people are, which is middle income.
College loan debt right now is just an all-time high, isn't it?
It is. It's astronomical. You figure 2 years ago, we crossed the $1 trillion mark when it comes to student loan debt. And as a matter of fact, this last year, we crossed $29,400 as the average that most students are taking out for college. And that, again, doesn't include the amount that the parents are taking out as well to help out with that.
So what advice do you have for people listening in terms of sitting back, really taking stock of what they need to be thinking about in terms of financial aspects?
I absolutely believe that a family has to start with the money talk. They've got to have an affordability conversation well before the time that they start to go do college visits or give their student the green light to start applying to schools. And I think the unfortunate part is that families just forget to do that. They just never get around to talking about the money, which is obviously a critical step in the entire process.
If people would like to learn more about you, Dan, and College and Beyond, what is your contact information?
They can go to collegeandbeyondllc.com. or candbtestprep.com, or give me a call at 859-283-2655.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Dan Bizig. Dan is a college expert, funding strategist, and founder of College and Beyond LLC, and College and Beyond Test Prep. And Dan, I know what you do really is you help families and students get into college. And all that encompasses both in terms of getting the students ready on the test prep side, also helping them with their applications, but also helping the families understand what they can afford and to some degree helping guide the students in terms of what type of degree should you get. Is that a big issue? What, you know, that students sometimes go to college, spend a lot of money, and come out with a degree that doesn't make them very employable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, how scary would it be to send a child to a $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000 a year school for them to major in psychology,
women's
social
studies.
Work, women's studies? Yeah. Or, you know, even being a teacher and realizing, okay, great education at a fantastic institution, but was it worth it to pursue that kind of career, understanding the dynamics of the world we live in today. It's no different than years ago. There was a lot of concern, for example, of engineering careers that were disappearing here in the United States because of the growth of opportunities in China and India. Thankfully, some of those jobs have come back. But there are still industries that have been decimated. Architecture, for example, is still a very, very difficult profession to get into, let alone the additional cost that it takes to get that degree. And so I absolutely counsel families all the time that you've got to be very smart in talking to your students, and students have to be smart in looking at potential careers so that they don't put themselves into a situation where they have an education and can't do anything with it.
And so, Dan, what can, just a follow-up to that, what can a family do to make sure that they don't commit financial suicide when it comes to allowing their student to pick their final college list?
Well, number one, they need to sit down and have really concrete conversations about where is the funding going to come from. You know, in some cases, the family just looks at the student and says, this is 100% on you, and you're going to have to figure this out, which means then that the student has to pick viable options that make sense financially. In other cases, the parents can indeed help, but they have to help the student understand what does that look like. You know, some students think that mom and dad can just cover 100% of the cost. I mean, even in my case with my wife and I, our son forever thought that we had everything covered, and yet what we actually had saved for was their tuition and fees. It became a conversation of understanding the value of the education they were getting and the scholarships that we were hoping that was going to lead to. College is a privilege. It's not a right. And especially when it comes to picking the schools, just because a student falls in love with a particular school doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right fit for that family, either financially or even academically for the student. I become the reality guy. I sit down and I ask the tough questions to make them think about the choices and decisions that they're making so that they don't put themselves into a very tough situation down the road. And so I ask, you know, what is that affordability threshold early enough to try to persuade that student to try to look at schools that will fit into that. I ask about the careers and I give some clarification on those types of things.
If folks listening would like more information about College and Beyond, how can they reach you?
They can go to collegeandbeyondllc.com or to candbtestprep.com. All of our contact information is on both of those websites.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, a recent article that we wrote for the Cincinnati Enquirer was in response to a question from an individual who was a freelancer. He was a sole proprietor, made more money in 2013 than he had anticipated, and he wanted to reduce his income by putting money into a retirement plan for himself, which in my mind is the best kind of tax deduction that you can get. And the question was, can he still do that now and take a deduction on his 2013 return?
Well, Crystal, in most instances, you need to have a retirement plan established by the end of your year in order to contribute to it and get a deduction for that year. But there is an exception to that, like there is in most things in tax, and that exception is for a SEP IRA, a Simplified Employee Pension IRA. You can establish one of those up until the time you file your tax return, make a contribution to it before you file your return, and you get a deduction on that return, on your 2013 return, even though you established the plan and contributed to it in 2014.
Yes, it's very easy to set up. It's probably the least expensive of the various plans that you can have to maintain. You can use it if you're a sole owner, a one-person business, or if you have employees, and only the employer makes the contributions to the plan on behalf of the employees if you do have them. You can contribute up to 20% of your self-employment income, which is basically your business income, minus half of your self-employment tax, but you are limited. For the 2013 year, you're limited to $51,000.
Well, and if you're not planning on putting that much money aside, you probably can contribute to an IRA. You can contribute to some type of IRA as long as you have earned income. And if you don't have another retirement plan that covers you, you should be able to contribute to a deductible IRA no matter how much income you make.
Yes, and that limit for 2013 is $5,500. If you're age 50 or older, the deduction's limited to $6,500, and you have until April 15th of 2014 to make that contribution for last year.
And there's other types of plans that you could start this year that you could deduct on your 2014 return if you're self-employed. A very popular one is the solo 401k, because you can put a substantial percentage of your income aside into a retirement plan if you're in a position to do that.
It's actually, in my mind, a better type of retirement plan in many cases, because your contribution limits are a lot higher, even if you don't make as much money in your company. That's a great type of plan. Another one is a simple IRA. That's a savings incentive match plan for employees. That amount, however, in 2014, the maximum amount is limited to $12,000. And if you're age 50 or older, it's $14,500. So the key is, there are many types of options for you as a small business to make a contribution, take a deduction for your own retirement, in essence, letting Uncle Sam help you subsidize your retirement. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Tom, now that tax season is in full swing, people are preparing the tax returns. They are looking forward to getting their refund checks. Many people, however, are also thinking about, what do I need to do or not do to avoid an IRS audit?
Well, and IRS audits are not pleasant. Even if you have nothing to hide, no concerns about adjustments, it's still a process that you have to go to, which is either expensive because you're hiring someone to represent you, or a chore because you've got to organize all your records in a better fashion than most people normally keep them and provide information to the IRS.
The majority of IRS audits are really in the form of a letter. They ask for explanations or supporting documents to substantiate some deduction that you claimed on your tax return, or oftentimes if you left income off, they also want to know where it's at and why you didn't report it.
Well, and the key is, if you do get correspondence from the IRS asking for information or really asking for anything, make sure that you respond within the timeline that they ask for it. Otherwise, you'll just start some chain of letters in motion that will end up with an adjustment to your tax return, which may be improper. So make sure you respond. If you don't know the response and you use someone else to do your tax return, ask that person and they can help.
One thing I do want to mention, because this is so important, I think we're all so accustomed to getting emails and so forth like that, the IRS will not contact you through email. So if you do get some kind of an email that looks like it's from the IRS, it's not. It's a scam. It's some kind of a trick. You don't want to respond to that or give any personal information. The IRS will contact you through letters. Sometimes they might actually give you a phone call. But even then, you have to be very careful about what kind of information you put forth.
There are some things that you can do to reduce your chances of being audited. I mean, a lot of the reasons you get audited are your income, your level of income. The higher it is, the more likely you are to get audited. And, you know, obviously, if you have high income, that's great. You just have a greater chance of getting audited. If you're self-employed, if you have a Schedule C on your tax return, there's a much greater chance of getting audited. And there are things you can do to avoid that. You can have a partnership. You can have a corporation. I mean, there's lots of considerations as to why you would do that. And I wouldn't do it just to reduce the chance of being audited. But it is something to think about when you form your entity for your business.
When you are in a business, especially a sole proprietorship that's reported on your Schedule C of Form 1040, and it happens to be a cash type of a business, then you are more susceptible to being audited. So certainly, you don't want to live a lavish lifestyle, big car, fancy house, but only report $25,000 of income on your tax return. That might stick out, and it will stick out. So clearly, you have to make sure that you report your income and know that your type of business is one that is subject to IRS scrutiny.
And also, if you have unusual deductions, for instance, you make $100,000 of income, but you make $50,000 of charitable contributions, that's going to stick out on your tax return and greatly increase your likelihood of being audited. It may be legitimate. You know, some people are very generous, but you better make sure that you have all the documentation necessary if you're going to take a deduction that's disproportionate to the amount of income that you have.
There are many things that trigger an IRS audit. The best thing to do is take a hard look at your tax return before you hit submit, if you're e-filing it or drop it in the mail, to make sure you can document all of the items of deduction and have all of your income included on your tax return. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Catherine Neal. Kathy is an associate professor of business ethics and business law at the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business at Northern Kentucky University. She's also a licensed attorney, and she's here today because she's recently published a book, Taking Down the Lion, The Triumphant Rise and Tragic Fall of Tyco's Dennis Kozlowski. Maybe you can tell us why you decided to write this book.
I, like you, had heard of Kozlowski from a lot of media attention when he went to trial and was convicted. I talked about him in my business ethics courses at NKU and was always confused about the case, could never quite make sense of the facts and how it led to his conviction. So I decided to start looking into the case in more depth, initially just so I could better explain it to students. Once I started digging in, the story was much more fascinating than I expected and ultimately led to the book.
Well, and you didn't actually know him before you started this, but you actually wrote to him first to see if he would correspond with you?
Correct. Didn't know him other than just seeing his name in newspapers and in my textbook. But yes, I wrote to him just out of curiosity at the prison where I believed he was at the time and just asked if he would be willing to answer a few questions for me, and he agreed. And that initial letter led to a lot of research and ultimately a book.
Did you come to the conclusion after you did your research that, in fact, he was guilty?
That's the conclusion I ultimately reached after looking through all of the evidence,
page
by page. He was not guilty. I reached the conclusion that he was not guilty, which was shocking to me because I, like you, believe that our system works most of the time. You know, I'm an attorney. I believe in the system. I like to believe that the system gets it right most of the time, although there are well-documented instances when it doesn't get things right. But in this case, I was surprised because you would expect someone with Kozlowski's resources to have had the best legal representation, and you figure if he's in jail, he deserved to be. But that's not what I found when I looked at the evidence.
He was tarnished by his lavish lifestyle, wasn't he?
He was. The media attention and the way that he spent his money, and he had lots of money. He was earning over $100 million a year for a few years in a row. So he had a lot of money, and he spent it on things that some of us might find to be excessive.
You don't have a $6,000 shower curtain in your bathroom?
I do not. I don't think Target makes a $6,000 shower curtain.
Maybe you can share one or two points about why you don't think he's guilty.
There is just no evidence to support some of the big crimes that he was charged with and convicted of. Grand larceny, based on him stealing four bonuses that were supposedly not approved by the board of directors. However, during the same time frame that he was allegedly stealing these bonuses, he turned down 1 million shares of Tyco stock offered to him by the board of directors. Why would anyone turn down legitimate compensation so that they can steal instead? There are 100 things or more like that that just don't add up.
If people would like to get the book, where can they find it?
It's available in all major bookstores and online, so you can find it just about anywhere.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Catherine Neal. Catherine Neal is an associate professor of business ethics and business law here at the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business in Northern Kentucky. She's an attorney, and she's also the author of a book, Taking Down the Lion, The Triumphant Rise and Tragic Fall of Tyco's Dennis Kozlowski. And Kathy, I know that you have taught your students about this case in your classes here at NKU. And it's interesting because from those teachings, you actually went and you wrote this book. Maybe you can share about how you approached the book, why you wrote the book, and how you got in front of Mr. Kozlowski.
When I first began working on this project, I had no thoughts of writing a book. I only really wanted to know what happened in this case because it didn't make sense to me. I wrote a letter to him out of the blue, didn't know him, didn't even know if he would receive it. And a few weeks after I sent that initial letter, he wrote back a handwritten letter from the prison in upstate New York where he was housed at the time. He said he would be happy to answer any questions that I had. So we started corresponding, and I asked him 1 million questions, which he had to handwrite the answers to, which I'm sure was a little burdensome for him. After several months, he asked me if I would like to come up to the prison and visit. He thought we could cover a lot more ground face-to-face, which we were able to. So I made the trip to Marcy, New York, which is literally in the middle of nowhere. All that's there are prisons. It was a daunting place where he lived and where he lived for many years.
So I think a lot of people would perceive a white-collar criminal like that being in what would be maybe a country club prison, but that's not the case for him, was it?
Not for Dennis Kozlowski. Yes, you hear club fed, yes. You know, for white collar criminals who go to prisons that have tennis courts and gardens. That's not what I saw at the prison where he was housed.
How did it feel when you first walked those prison doors?
It felt scary. I had never been in a prison. I had to, just to get in as a visitor, go through an extensive screening process through many gates that clang shut behind you, which is an interesting experience for someone who's never been there. And you're in there with convicted felons. You're surrounded by convicted felons. So it's a little scary.
You know, in your book, you come to the conclusion that you believe that Kozlowski was not guilty of the crimes he was convicted of. What do you think caused him to get convicted? What mistakes did he make that did cause his conviction, even though he may not have been guilty of those crimes?
Some of his basic philosophies about managing a business came back to hurt him. To this day, he's convinced that it's the best way to run a company. But when he argues that, I point out that he's in prison. So, I win that argument. He wasn't very careful about making sure there were internal controls in place, making sure that records were kept the way that they should have been. The company grew so quickly that they didn't grow corporate operations quickly enough along with the growth of the company. So it ran kind of like a mom and pop shop, even though it was a huge multinational conglomerate. They skipped over some corporate formalities. When he needed to have documentation of decisions that had been made that would have saved him from any of the trouble that he found himself in, there was no documentation to be found.
I know that Dennis Kozlowski has recently been released from prison.
He was, January 17th.
How's he doing?
He's happy, as you might imagine. After spending 8 1/3 years in the New York State prison system, he is on parole. He's looking forward to rebuilding his life. I know at this point he's trying to figure out what he's going to do. He needs a job, and so he's looking for the next stage of his life.
If people listening, Kathy, would like to get the book, where can they find your book?
The book's available in all major bookstores and Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Again, the book is Taking Down the Lion. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Kevin Berlon. Kevin is an assistant vice president with Union Savings Bank. He's also a construction and residential mortgage loan originator. And Kevin, I came to find out recently, was one of the authorized signers of insurance claim checks on behalf of the bank. And Kevin, I met you recently about a week ago because I had the unfortunate occurrence of having a casualty loss at my house. We had, like a lot of people in this area, we had a frozen pipe that burst, and so we had an insurance claim. I was very happy to quickly get a check from my insurance company, but a little less happy when I saw that it had your bank as a payee on it. And maybe you can explain just why that is. I mean, because you were my mortgage holder, that's why. But why is it that the mortgage holder is the payee on the insurance check as well as the homeowner?
As long as there is a mortgage or an amount borrowed with the house being held as collateral, the bank really has a vested interest in the condition of the property, which is why we are listed as a loss payee on your insurance policy.
Well, how awkward is it? I mean, it was very painless for me. I just had to go out, tell you my circumstances, and you endorse the check. But is it always that smooth, or is there another process sometimes depending upon the amount of equity and the amount of damage that you have?
Every bank treats it differently. And the way that we try to treat it is that we do have to consider a lot of different factors. There are really 5 different types of insurance checks in the event of a damaging loss event, like wind or hail damage to a roof or broken pipe damage, similar to what you had with the interior of your house. Only 4 of those kind of checks really need the bank's endorsement. Typically, you'll see a contents kind of check, and that does not typically come with our name on it. There's remediation to the property. There's repair. There's a supplemental check, which sometimes occurs when more work is needed than the adjuster originally estimated. And then finally, there's a recoverable depreciation check.
What exactly is recoverable depreciation?
Recoverable depreciation clause really ensures that the policyholder uses the money issued by the insurer for the actual replacement of the item before further money is issued for the depreciation value. This both minimizes insurance fraud and it also contributes to lower monthly premiums.
You know, I had $14,000 of damages, say, but my check was only for $9,000 or $10,000. That difference that they hold back, that recoverable depreciation, I'll collect that if indeed I actually incur out-of-pocket expenses of $14,000.
Correct, and that's usually managed by the insurer.
So does the bank get notification right out the gate when there's been an issue, or do you just learn of this damage when somebody shows up and wants the check endorsed?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't find out until the insurer comes to us. And by the terms of their mortgage, they are responsible for letting us know of damage of any type like this.
What advice do you have for people, Kevin, as it relates to this?
Well, first of all, call ahead. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's probably the best piece of advice I could give at this point in time. Each bank really handles things differently. They all have their different procedures. Some require an inspection. Some will let you sign at the local branch. Some will require you to mail the check away to a processing center someplace out of state.
So if folks listening would like to learn more about this topic, learn more about Union Savings Bank, Kevin, what's your contact information?
We can be reached here in Cincinnati at our main headquarters at 513-247-0300 and ask for somebody either in the insurance department or in the construction department.
Kevin, thanks for that great advice, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Kevin Berlon. Kevin is an assistant vice president with Union Savings Bank. Kevin is the construction and residential mortgage loan originator. And everybody's interested in mortgage rates, I think, whether they have a current mortgage or whether they're looking at buying a home. What are you seeing in terms of trends? Are mortgage rates fairly stable right now?
Actually, we've seen a lot of stability recently in mortgage rates coming out of all-time historic lows. In the interest rate market, I believe that we're finally kind of stabilizing right now. Naturally, we're all concerned about what the new Fed chairwoman will do in terms of her strategy and how that will impact long-term rates.
What are some guidelines? What are some tips that you have for people who are looking to buy a home in terms of getting their mortgage all lined up and make sure that they're going to qualify for the kind of mortgage that they need and the rate that they're a desirable rate?
Certainly. Well, this is very timely as my daughter is looking to purchase her first home. And we just sat down this past weekend to take a look at their finances on an overall basis. And we've taken a look at both what their income is, which has been stabilized for the last 2 years. We've taken a look at what their expenses are on a monthly basis. And then from there, we've applied some of the standard debt-to-income ratios to identify what purchase price of a house they would actually be able to afford.
And that's really what people should do, especially if they're first-time buyers, is either by themselves or with a loan officer like you, sit down, and they can actually get a pre-approval, can't they?
Yes, we actually call it a pre-qualification, and that way we can help identify what kind of a price range would make most sense for them. And then we can actually issue a letter which could be used to present to the seller to give them a greater comfort level that this has been a very serious buyer.
And it may even make the difference between two potential buyers. If one has a qualification letter and the other doesn't, the seller might choose even at a lesser price many times because they know they have a qualified buyer.
Yes, I've seen that happen in the market.
What is the rule of thumb for the amount of bring home pay that you can afford? How much house can you afford? What's the percentage?
Well, the ideal situation for your PITI, which stands for principal, interest, taxes, and insurance, you should take that monthly total and divide it into your income, and it should be about 28%, 28 to 30% of your total gross monthly income. And then what you do is you would take the rest of your monthly debts, your credit card payments, your auto payment,
student loan payments,
and add that in. And then that total should be in the 38 to 40%, probably no more than 40%.
If you do that math and you end up in a price range that's not enough, in other words, you want a more expensive home, the key would be getting rid of some of your other debt, paying that off as quickly as you can so that in total you'll be able to qualify for a larger loan.
Correct. And there's also other ways such as the FHA loans, which do allow some higher percentages, and you could probably go up to 45% total debt to your monthly income.
So, Kevin, if folks listening would like to learn more about how Union Savings Bank can help them, maybe help them determine how much house they can afford, what is your contact information?
Crystal, we can be reached at 513-247-0300 and ask for somebody in the lending department.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Leanne Hamilton. Leanne is the business editor at The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com. Leanne oversees a team of reporters who report on the region's largest companies, as well as so many other issues, Leanne, including transportation, economic development, commercial and residential real estate, just business in general, and how it impacts people here in our region. I've really got the sense over the last several months that the climate is just getting better. I can see business owners actually taking risks and getting out there and doing things that they haven't really done in several years, really. Are you getting the same sense?
We're picking up some of that also. For instance, small businesses seem to be heading to the banks more often, and the banks are a little bit more willing to lend money for capital improvements and for expansions and for hirings. I don't think anybody is wanting to jump on the bandwagon, though, and just go screaming into the future that the recession is over and everything is fine.
It seems like for the first time in several years, we're seeing construction for something outside of the healthcare industry. I mean, their construction boom seemed to continue.
And schools.
And schools. So the public sector, but really in the private sector, partly because of financing, I think, and partly because of risk taking. You just haven't seen a lot of that until more recently.
I think that's true. And that's an interesting point, too, about the healthcare business, because for so long, that was the leading sector as far as new jobs. And now, certainly, healthcare is still very important. But coming up very strong and, you know, right on its heels are the IT sector and digital software developers. You know, the sense that I hear is that Cincinnati and the greater Cincinnati area is developing a reputation for being a place where startups are doing well and where investors should look to come to perhaps pump some money into businesses.
Well, not only do investors come here, but we've actually interviewed a couple of startups where the people came here specifically to start their business, specifically because of the climate for startups in Cincinnati.
For example, the Brandery. The Brandery is just an amazing organization because it really is helping startups who are in that whole space of branding, commercialization. Certainly, we've got Procter & Gamble, Kroger, Macy's, all of these organizations that have fostered that whole brand-type servicing industry.
The marketing and branding and advertising industry in Cincinnati is huge. And you mentioned the Brandery. The Brandery is known nationally. Also becoming known everywhere is a group like Centrifuge, as a place where businesses can come together and receive funding and mentorship with some of the biggest corporations in our town.
Yes, it really does speak, I think, to the fact that even the largest corporations in our region are really embracing this whole concept of entrepreneurship and really encouraging small business growth, which ultimately will generate jobs. Leanne, thank you so much. If folks want to learn more about what's going on in our region, they can just go to Cincinnati.com. They can also, and I would highly recommend that they encourage, or I would encourage them to take a look at The Enquirer, because it's a wonderful publication. It's new and it's different.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak with everyone today.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Catherine Neal. Kathy is an associate professor of business ethics and business law here at the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business at Northern Kentucky University. She's an attorney, and she's also an author of a book, Taking Down the Lion, The Triumphant Rise and Tragic Fall of Tyco's Dennis Kozlowski. This book is fascinating. It really tells the story, probably the untold story, that caused Dennis Kozlowski, who was the CEO of Tyco, to go to prison for what, 8 1/3 years?
8 1/3 years, yes.
Originally, you didn't know if he was guilty or not. I think most of us assume that our justice system works right, and he was guilty because the jury of our peers said so. You wrote the book. You figured he was not, based on your 2.5 years of very in-depth research. Why do you think he was found guilty?
I approach this project from this perspective. What can we learn from that? That's just my bent on this is, you know, what can I tell students to do to protect themselves so this tragedy never happens in their career and in their lives? Probably the number one lesson that I would tell anyone who is or aspires to be a corporate executive is to take care of yourself. You are responsible for you, and you can't count on other people to take care of your responsibilities. You're still accountable. And the other things I found in this case are, you know, you can't count on loyalty to save you. You can't count on the justice system to necessarily save you if you haven't taken care of yourself. You know, in this case, the legal system got it wrong, which is disheartening for me as a member of the legal profession.
A lot of people think the legal system is unfair because you see, for instance, a disproportionate number of African Americans in prison versus Caucasians. But in this case, it may have been unfair because there was a very wealthy person. It wasn't a racial issue. It was an economic issue. And he was being judged by, you know, supposedly a jury of his peers, but really they weren't his peers in terms of economics. They were the opposite of him, I assume.
I looked at the composition of the jury, and I even met with the man who was the jury foreman.
Who was how old?
He was 22 at the time, for a five-month-long trial with evidence that included the most sophisticated accounting and financial transactions that exist in the world of business. I mean, this is a huge multinational company. I know that the jurors could not have understood a great deal of the information. The jury foreman at 22 was the only jury member who had a college degree. And that's not saying that these people weren't intelligent. It's just to understand this information, you have to have the background.
So the lesson that you tell your students, when you earlier said that you have to take care of yourself if you're a corporate executive, what do you mean by that, take care of yourself?
We all dislike having to take care of formalities to make sure that things are documented the way they are. Business executives hate when laws are passed that require them to do more work. Like Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, which was a result of the scandals that happened about the same time that the Tyco scandal happened. Businesses hate that because it's expensive. Those rules are there for a reason, and it's not to hurt you. It is to save you.
So in other words, document minute books. Make sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's as it relates to corporate formalities, because in this case, it's different than, say, the Enron case, isn't it?
Very different, yes. There was no accounting fraud here.
So the big takeaway is, if you are in business, if you're a C-level, especially if you're a CFO, owner, corporate executive, you have to make sure that you're doing that, because we can't count on the justice system all the time to protect us.
You can't fix it later. Right, exactly right.
Kathy, if people want to pick up your book, they want to read Taking Down the Lion, where can they find the book?
The book's available in all major bookstores, on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. It's also an iBook. It's also available through Kindle.
Thank you so much for being our guest, and thank you for listening to BusinessWise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.